Leadership Garage Podcast.
Keith Devlin is an emeritus mathematician at Stanford University, author, and well-known as the Math Guy from NPR's Weekend Edition, a recurring American public radio program. In this recording, he gives a concise history of Stanford University and the factors that it took to create Silicon Valley's ecosystem during a lecture for the Leadership Garage's Fall 2018 Inside Silicon Valley Symposium. In the course of the presentation, he discusses some slides that compare the entrepreneurial activity from four universities. You'll find those in the show notes.
Okay, Stanford. I'll start with Stanford and then I'll sort of work outwards to Silicon Valley because the two are very closely interlinked. And actually, this is a story that is not that well known. I didn't know it until I came here and started talking to people that had been part of it. And then discovered it. And actually, since I've been here, a whole bunch of books, there must be a dozen, maybe more books now that describe this whole history I'm going to tell you. But it's a history that goes back into the 19th century in Massachusetts. And then it ended up with Stanford and Silicon Valley. And we can do the whole thing in 45 minutes, and that's what I'm going to do. So the university as a whole. Okay, it started in 1891. Officially its name is the Leland Stanford Junior University. Leland Stanford and his wife had a big ranch out here. We're sitting in the middle of their ranch. It's called The Farm, actually. The sort of local name for Stanford University is The Farm, because we're in the middle of this big farm, horse ranch, that stretched out many, many acres. And Leland Stanford was he was a politician on the East Coast. He was also an engineer. If you ever watch that movie, How the West Was Won, and that kind of things, it was putting the railroads across the United States. He was one of those guys that put railroads across the United States, and then Clint Eastwood comes along and saves people. So that's what Leland Stanford did. They had a son called Leland Stanford Jr., and he died tragically very young, and as a memorial to their dead son, they created Leland Stanford Junior University, nowadays just known as Stanford University. The goal in founding it, not surprisingly, given that Leland Stanford himself, Leland Stanford Sr., was a big thinker. You know, let's put railways across the entire United States. Let's turn this great continent into a nation. So that was big thinking. And the mission of Stanford University when it was founded wasn't just educate people, it was educate the next generation of leaders, national and global leaders. It was a big thinking university. It didn't actually work out that way until circumstances came along and gave Stanford the opportunity to become a large, powerful university. That wasn't until the 1950s. Until then, Stanford, despite its grand founding documents, was essentially a party school for the sons and daughters of wealthy parents. It was a play school. You just came here, and if you couldn't get into one of the big universities on the East Coast or you lived on the West Coast, you would come to Stanford. For various reasons, it did have some very remarkable people here, but they were not because of the university. They were because of other things that were going on around here. Okay, it's very unusual. Very few universities in the United States that has everything, a medical school, a law school, a business school. You know, most places have one or two of those, but to have them all, it's very unusual. And west of the Mississippi, I think it's still the only one that you can include in that one. So it's a very unusual university in the spread of different areas that it has, different faculties. It's very small in terms of faculty. When I first came here, that figure was 1,700. It's now grown somewhat to 2,200 and almost 2,220. But that's small by almost every university standards in the world. The undergraduate population has also been going up a little bit since I got here, but not much. So that's tiny, tiny, tiny in terms of undergraduates. In fact, if it wasn't Stanford in the United States, that would be called a college with that many students. So it's okay, which actually Harvard does. Harvard is also sort of like that, and they call it Harvard College if you actually look into it. So that's a very small number of students. It is globally big, 76 countries. These are the latest figures. So we have a lot of spread in the world. It's a very attractive place to come. It's actually the most difficult university in the world to get into now for reasons that we may be a little bit worried about. The graduate population is huge, way beyond the undergraduate. This is really what Stanford's about. It's about the graduate research university, very large graduate school from pretty well any country that you could imagine might want to have graduate students in the United States. The budget is kind of big. The last year, the actual overall budget for the university was $6.3 billion. And the research budget is $1.64 billion last year. That's an incredible spend on research. Now, it's a private university and Silicon Valley is around us and everyone thinks, oh, there's all of this money, there's venture capitalists, and yes, there are. But it's still the case that this university, like every other university in the world, could not survive without federal funding. Four-fifths of the money is federal. That figure's been steady for decades. What's left? The extra almost 20%, if you're talking about that, 20% is a lot of money. You know, we're talking about $300 million or a little bit more than that. So there's a lot of money comes from non-federal sources, from industry and other private donations, probably only exceeded by Harvard and maybe Princeton, but it's certainly way up there in terms of donations. So it is a significant factor. And in fact, my own center, the H-Star Center, the Institute, most of the money that comes through our, let me just put it this way. My center sort of it reflects those figures. We have a lot of fundamental research which is funded by the federal government, but we also have about a fifth of our research which is funded from private sources. And some of our infrastructure is funded by private sources. Okay, but the rest is all government.
How much does the state of California get involved?
When
you say government, is that?
It's mainly federal government. National Science Foundation, National Institute for the Human for the Arts. I mean, those kind of organizations. In fact, let me think. I guess in the humanities, there are some programs that get small grants from Sacramento. Education is probably small grants from individuals, but it's tiny. This is really federal. I just said government. I could have written federal because that's essentially true. There are small amounts, but not a lot. Which is interesting because, you know, California is the fifth largest economy in the world. So it figures as a nation, but the structure is that it all comes from federal sources. Okay. Actually, it was the case when there was a problem a few years ago with genome research. And there was a period when the feds, I think this was under George W. Bush, put a clamp on funding for genomics research, at least anything to do with fetuses. I mean, human genome related research. And then some people did get funding from the state because Governor Brown, I can't remember whether it was Governor Brown at the time, but whoever was in the governor's office, and it probably was Brown, allocated some funds to support research here to avoid leading human genome researchers going somewhere else and leaving the state. So the state did come in to sort of rescue things for a while. This is a sort of just a spread of the, you know, this is what you can do if you've got millions and millions of dollars. The only university that has a much bigger endowment is Harvard. And then beyond Harvard, we're one of the top two or three for endowments. So we've got a lot of living Nobel Prize winners, 17 at the moment, 31 over all time, bunch of Pulitzers, MacArthurs. I mean, this is the medals table, as it were, literally the medals table in many cases. So, and it's essentially a reflection of wealth and then attractiveness. If you're an academic, a researcher, I don't think there's anywhere in the world better than this. I've been a researcher and an academic all over the world. I was in Heidelberg for a year, Bonn for 2 years. I was in Oslo for a while. I've been in various other universities in the States. I was in the UK for several years. So I've moved around in my career and been in many countries and had good support. But not when I came to Stanford in 85, actually, I came as a visitor. Then I came back full time in 87. There was nothing like it in terms of an infrastructure support. With one caveat, you have to get the money yourself if you're here. There are staff that will help you raise money, but if you come here, the deal is you have to raise the money to support your research by going for grants, etc. Now, it's true that, as I say, there is support available, but this is a very owner-occupied sort of, I mean, owner-driven, owner-directed thing in the sense that the faculty, it's their job to be individual faculty that raise the money that they need. You do not go to the university and ask for money because you won't get it, except maybe small amounts of seed funding, which are very competitive. One of the things that MediaX does, which is the industry program that I co-founded, which is part of HSTAR, what MediaX does is it does provide small amounts of seed funding for projects on the assumption that after 6 months with seed funding, and we cap that at $75,000, typically, after that, that project has to find funding from elsewhere. So Stanford provides facilities and it provides an incredibly good logo to get funding, but it's up to the individuals. It's classic America, right? It's classic, Clint Eastwood in the Wild West standing up for himself sort of deal, which has its good side and its bad side. Okay, so the result is of all of this wealth and activity is we're able to recruit people just like football teams. You know, you've got a really good player in football or whatever else, that player will get bought and sold. And so Stanford buys good people all over the place. For many years, we had someone here who was on the Nobel Committee, a Swedish guy who was here. He'd been at Xerox. And he got well beyond retiring age. In fact, he stayed here until he finally passed away a few years ago. Okay, right. So there's all of this stuff. And not surprising, if you've got money and great faculty, then you end up doing an awful lot of world-shattering discoveries. Some of the more recent big ones. Well, there are more recent ones, but these are the ones that are sort of clearly big, like Google Search Engine, DSL, et cetera, the music synthesizer. It is probably worth mentioning that Stanford really makes almost no money from these things. We have an Office of Technology Licensing, and they do license things out, other than sort of work in biochemistry. Almost none of the patents make a lot of money. I think Stanford has three technology patents that make more than $1 million a year. And $1 million by Stanford's budget is tiny. Then there's maybe a dozen or so. This is all on the web, you can find it. There's maybe a dozen patents that make $100,000 a year or more. And then the rest make essentially none. This one, for example, doesn't make any money for Stanford, except Stanford Development has stock in Google when it went public. But the when Google was formed, Stanford had no ownership in that. It was just went off campus, as it were. And even when we do have ownership in a patent, the deal is that Stanford, the institution, will take 1/3 of the patent revenues. The department in which the invention came from will take 1/3, and the individual will take 1/3. So it's split up between the three groups that could arguably be said to have been important in getting the patent out there. Interestingly enough, I've talked to development offices in many European universities about that model, and it just floors them because their view is that they should, as a university, should own everything. Now, there's two things to that. First of all, if you take away the individual incentive, then you're taking away a lot. And secondly, there's not really any value in a university owning patents. Arguably, one of the most important patents in the history of technology is the router that Cisco Systems marketed, and Stanford essentially sold the patent for, I think, maybe $10,000 or something like that. You might want to ask yourself, why did not Stanford defend the patent on the router that was the founding technology of Cisco Systems? And the clue is, how would they defend it against Cisco Systems, the company that at the time had the greatest market cap in the world? Now, Stanford's wealthy, but it's not going to go to a legal fight with something of the order of Cisco. So you can't defend them anyway. So some of them make a reasonable amount of revenue, but it's not a huge amount. This one actually makes, it's one of the three tech ones that makes more than $1 million. That's the music synthesizer. And that was an accident. They tried to market it in the US. They tried to do something. They couldn't when this guy, John Chowning, in the music department came up with the synthesizer. And in the end, there was this thing going begging, and Yamaha came along and said, well, we're kind of interested in that. And then they negotiated a price. I'm not sure what the price is. But Yamaha bought it and then turned it into this very successful technology. So this is not about money. The patents are there for other reasons, but it's not about making money. Okay, and there's a whole bunch of these things. Okay, there's also Stanford Research Park. Part of the land that Stanford owns, part of the original farm, is the other side of Page Mill Road, and then round the back. And that's where you'll find various German automobile companies that have their research labs here in this area. All sorts of other companies. Hewlett-Packard being one of the first ones on there. Varian Associates was actually the very first one. And if you drive around, or even better, if you go on a bicycle around the streets around the back of campus, you'll go through a history of Silicon Valley just by the names outside the buildings, at least the names of the ones where the name still means something and the company still exists. It was set up in 1951, the beginnings of the Cold War. We're going to be getting into the Cold War, because this was the period when Stanford became a global university and a technological powerhouse. There's over 150 companies, predominantly in tech. There's about 162 buildings, 10 million square feet, about 23,000 things, all on Stanford land. Okay, and that's actually Hewlett and Packard and Fred Terman, the Dean of Engineering at the time. Okay, and here's just a few of the spin-offs. There's over 200. Well, the question is, what do you mean by a company? You mean a company that sort of was created and then lasted for a while. You know, it had some revenues and it existed for some time. I'm sure on the website you'll find a definition of what's this. But you pick some definition, and certainly, I'm listing really big ones. These are genuine companies that have been founded. I mean, I'm sure my company technically is not a Stanford spin-off, even though I'm at Stanford. That's just because of the history of the IP. Although if we made a lot of money, I suspect the lawyers would start arguing about that. But my view is that it's not a Stanford spin-off because it's not directly related. And even if it were, I doubt if we'd make it. Although we've actually survived for 4 years, so maybe it would make it somehow. And we have made money, but the net flow of money is out, not in, because we're in education. And you don't make money out of educational content. You spend money on educational content. One of the big myths in Silicon Valley is there's money to be made out of education. Well, there's money to be made out of the education community and the education world, but not out of education itself, as everyone discovered when they thought the MOOCs were going to do that, etc. I know, those are other stories, but we can come back to them. You know, I'm going to say something and then we'll chat. Okay, so here's some of the most successful ones, and some of them were successful but no longer exist, and some do. There's Coursera, the MOOC platform, and the Udacity, the MOOC platform. Nike is an unusual one. We tend to think technology, but you know, there's the Knight Business Center. The new business school is called the Knight Business Center. That's the Knight that founded Nike. MIPS Technologies is the company founded by the former president of Stanford, John Hennessy. MIPS chips. MathWorks is still a fairly successful company. Logitech was the mouse originally. LinkedIn, I like the LinkedIn because the guy that founded that was one of my students when I first came in the 80s. So as a result of him, Reid Hoffman, the average salary of students I've taught is incredibly high. But he's a single node of that. And then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of interesting things there. Okay, I said, and Varian was the first one that was on the technology park. So we've got a lot of stuff coming out of here. In fact, I think it's worth going into this a little bit more, because, you know, ever since Silicon Valley became big, essentially in the 80s, Silicon Valley, as we now think of it, was essentially caused by the Apple IPO, which has nothing to do with Stanford at all. It was these guys down in Cupertino. That was the thing that made it big. That's when the venture capital started coming in. It was the Apple IPO that was, literally just dropouts that had got into business by cheating the phone companies that suddenly ended up with the Apple II and so forth. So people always say, well, can we recreate Silicon Valley? Can we do this same thing somewhere else? And it's been tried, right? Pittsburgh, Research Triangle Park on the East Coast, Austin, Texas, various other parts in the world, Silicon Glen in Scotland, the corridor between the UK, between London and Bath in the UK, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All over the world, people have done these things, and they've been certainly successful, but nothing like as successful as Silicon Valley. And this is some research that was done by a colleague of mine here a few years ago, Martha Russell, who's the executive director of MediaX, which is the way that HSTAR interacts with industry. And she looked at four universities, and she compared the entrepreneurial activity coming out of those universities. Okay, so this was actually published in 2011, and this is MIT. And what's going on is that, let me seem to remind myself, that the blue dots are the people that came out of MIT, and the red dots are the companies they founded. And some people founded a lot of companies, so they get lots of red dots. Some people only have one. It's this person, whoever this person is. And the size of the dot is the size of the activity. The paper gives the definition of all these things. Years ago when the paper came out, I read it and I knew what these things actually meant, but they're in the paper. So you've got this activity. Here's someone very entrepreneurial. Here's someone sort of average entrepreneurial. If I had a node, there would just be one red dot attached to it, essentially. So I would probably wouldn't even make this thing. But that's MIT. Red dots are companies. The red size of the dot indicates the size. The number of dots indicates the number of companies. The size of the individual dot is how big an influence that person had in terms of creating companies. So the size of the blue dot reflects the number of red dots. So it gives us a nice way of looking at this. And this is I guess this is Lincoln Labs or something like that. This is a separate lab of MIT that's part of MIT and sort of partially out of it. Okay, so that's MIT. As you might imagine, there's a lot of entrepreneurial activity. This is Berkeley. Now, Berkeley is MIT is very tiny. It's small, way smaller than Stanford. And it's really just engineering. And yet it does have humanities, but it is explicitly an engineering school. So Berkeley is smaller. MIT is smaller. Berkeley is a huge university, a state university, a very famous and a good one. So everything is bigger. But if you look at the sort of the number, the relative, scale everything. It's basically just a issue of scale. That's essentially the same degree of activity taking account the bigger size. Everything's bigger, but it's roughly the same kind of graph. It looks essentially the same. Okay. So it makes sense to compare MIT and Berkeley, because Berkeley has got a lot of stuff coming out of it, especially in the biotech world. There's a lot of companies came out of Berkeley. That's actually not a surprise, because biotech research is expensive and big state schools are going to be much more to access to do it than Stanford even. So you would expect, if you think about it, that biotech, you're going to get a leaning towards a big state school as opposed to an MIT or a Stanford, just because of the cost of the research and the funding that goes into big schools. So very similar, though, very similar activity. You may be surprised at the third university that they compared MIT and Berkeley with, and it was Harvard. Now, you tend not to think about Harvard in terms of entrepreneurship. It's a sort of traditional university. It does all sorts of things. And even when they have people like, Gates or Zuckerberg, it's sort of students that drop out and sort of go somewhere else. So we don't think of Harvard as producing hundreds of engineers that make inventions and found companies, and they don't. So why? What's making Harvard look at least as strong as MIT and Berkeley? Who are these guys? Let me ask the question a different way. What degree do you think they got? Law. Law and business. Harvard Business School. These are the guys that form the CEOs of the companies. You got smart guys out here. Stanford produces them as well. That's essentially Harvard Business School more than anything. Yeah. So that's what's going on there. And once you realize that it takes business savvy to start a company, yeah, Harvard's going to be in there. And you get a graph that's essentially the same. It's just that this is, in reality, when you go to the ground, this is on the business side, whereas the MIT and the Berkeley is more on the technology side, the science side. But it takes those two sides and more to found a company that survives long enough to make the chart. Well, there's one more university we need to put into the mix, and that's Stanford. And the question would be, Stanford is bigger than MIT. It's bigger than, I'm not sure whether it's technically bigger than Stanford and Harvard, but it's sort of, in many ways, it's a good comparison. Berkeley is much bigger, but it's not a private university. It's a state university. So you might expect you're going to get something similar. It was, in fact, you get something very different. That is a whole different thing. That's carpet bombing the whole chart. I mean, there's more color there than there is white space almost. Actually, as a mathematician, I know that's false, but it looks that way. Okay. That's why you can never win in these things in the theme parks where you have to throw darts or shoot at things and you think, wow, it's going to be easy to hit those dots. But if you work out the areas, the odds are heavily against you. You know, we tend to think of that. But anyway, it's certainly quite different. That's a whole order of magnitude different. I mean, it's just a totally different thing. So that in just simple charts shows that there's something here that's very different from anywhere else, certainly in the United States. In fact, when they finished this paper, they asked an interesting question, and I'll put this in because this is a European audience. You might ask yourself, how does Stanford or the Bay Area in general, let's just say the Bay Area, how does that figure in terms of Europe? I mean, Europe has a very active innovation hub. I mean, you guys are part of that, right? How do we stack up against that? So here's what they did. The same researchers, this was in a year later, 2012, and looked at EIT ICT labs, Paris, Berlin, Stockholm, Helsinki, Eindhoven, Trento, and they looked at the activity in the same sort of way. There's Berlin, there's Paris, there's Eindhoven. Can hardly read it from here. There's Stockholm. Yeah. So anyway, there we go. That's the those are the same kind of thing. And then you ask yourself, okay, what if the Bay Area, which is mainly Stanford, but not exclusively, what if that was added to there? How would it look? I mean, would it dominate that? What would it look like compared with that? So this was the question they said. We were intrigued by the fact that in all our findings in which we were concentrating on Europe, Silicon Valley actors and their importance in connecting European actors was observed. For example, a presence of Intel Capital, financial actor, and Harvard and Stanford educational actors was perceived through our visualizations as well as through the metrics that are the basis for the visualization. So the same methodology, but they just put the Bay Area in, as I say, predominantly Stanford, and certainly Stanford and Silicon Valley. And there was a separate thing with Harvard. So they got this, it was a player. Stuff was going through here. This was done by looking at communications and stuff traveling between the two. Again, the paper tells you what they were measuring. So they actually went and said, okay, let's put it into the graph. Let's put it in. Let's just pretend it's part of Europe and see whether it's bigger than Berlin or smaller than Berlin or bigger than Paris, smaller than Paris. Just see where it fits in this thing, because it is a long way away. You know, it's 5,000 miles away. So how big is the floor? So that was the question. What would it look like if we put the Bay Area into that? How would the chart change? And then we'll move things around. You know, you always move it around so the big one's in the middle and you make it look easy to look at. So we'll put the Bay Area in, and then we'll just let the graph adjust itself, usually automatically, so that everything sort of, the big one's in the middle and everything's around it. That's it. That's the Bay Area. The rest of that network are those little dots around the outside. This is the sun and those are the planets. In other words, it's dominant, hugely dominant. Of course, you know, there's some obvious reasons. It's, you know, most of the world's venture capital is down Sand Hill Road. So of course it goes through the Bay Area. You've got all of the big hubs of computer networks. It's built into the system, but it's really dramatic how much it is. So it's completely dominant. Okay, so how did it get to be like that? I mean, this is weird. You know, there are smart people here. There are smart people everywhere in the world. What's different? Because this is clearly different from anywhere else by an enormous amount. Well, first of all, and this is two slides. I'm going to give you the entire history of Silicon Valley in two slides. It's all words, but they're just coming on one at a time. Okay. The name itself is relatively recent. It was in a magazine article in 1971. There's a history of it. Until then, it was known officially as this valley. This is really between San Francisco and San Jose, between the bay on one side and the coastal range on the other side. That's officially the Santa Clara Valley. We're actually now in Santa Clara County, but the valley was called officially the Santa Clara Valley. It was also known locally as the Valley of Heart's Delight, because in the 50s and 60s, it was all orchards. It was a beautiful climate then. This was before we had these extremes. There were orchards everywhere with apricots and peaches and oranges and lemons and things. And just in tiny little villages like Palo Alto and Menlo Park and a few roads going through. And if you look at photos from the 40s and 50s, this looks like heaven on earth. The scent in the spring with the fruit trees must have been gorgeous. It was the Valley of Heart's Delight. And its own demise and transformation was built into that very ecosystem that was there then. But there was always technology, so that mostly it was agriculture. Agriculture requiring high temperatures for long periods of time. Wines came in much later. They came in, but they only got big much later, starting in the Napa Valley and Sonoma and now all over the place. Okay, so all of these things came in, but things got big within the last few decades. And technology is the same. It goes back to the early 20th century, and that was naval technology, the big shipyard in Oakland on the East Bay. And then there was a naval air base down in Sunnyvale that was commissioned in 1933. It was then called the Naval Air Station, and it then became NASA Moffett Field, and then eventually became NASA Moffett Field. Okay, it was originally Naval Air Station Moffett Field, but then they found another name where you could use essentially NAS but with an A on the end. So, and that's the thing just down on Highway 101. And then you've got all these companies that sprang up to supply goods and services to the Navy. But then the Navy moved to San Diego, and that was when. The whole thing transformed, and it became eventually what became NASA. So they took over Moffett Field, and so you've got the main contract issuer, the Navy, going down to San Diego. So you've got all these companies based here that sort of look to other things in order to sort of keep going, and they didn't all. Some moved, but quite a few stayed. And it became aerospace, with Lockheed being one of the drivers. So you've got this. It's kind of interesting that if you look at San Diego, where these guys went. One of the more interesting things is San Diego, which has also had. When you export these communities, you're exporting an entrepreneurial community. And San Diego and Stanford and Silicon Valley, what was taken over, the entrepreneurship was in technology. Interestingly enough, in San Diego, and because that was dominant here, when the San Diego entrepreneurship, when contractors got, there was less to do, the sort of entrepreneurial culture said, well, what are we going to do with all of these entrepreneurs here? They said, well, we should do biotech. So they originally put money into biotech, and it didn't work for a whole variety of reasons, of which we have experts on the Stanford campus that have written books on this. So they tried to do biotech, and that didn't work. So they said, what can we be entrepreneurial about to build a successful new infrastructure? And they came up with actually a classic, this is a German solution. They said, beer. We will build beer. We will go about creating beer the same way Napa Valley went about creating wines. We'll take everything that's known in Germany and the UK and all these other countries, Czechoslovakia, and we'll add technology and we'll do it entrepreneurially and we make better beer. And they came up with the best IPAs in the world. So, but it's interesting that you can, entrepreneurship, you can just take it anywhere, but they literally applied a Silicon Valley approach to creating beer. And that's why suddenly out of nowhere, half the IPAs you buy in the world now come from San Diego. Although one of their companies did go bust recently. Okay, so that's the first slide. Now part two, taken a bit more recently. Now we're into the 1950s. Okay, now here's the Stanford story. Okay, and I said it begins in the 19th century. So, and I'm going to tell you this story because this explains why what happens here does happen here and didn't happen anywhere else, because it was a set of rather scary circumstances that we hope the world will never see again. So the 19th century in Massachusetts, you've got mills. I mean, it's an old mill community. You've got rivers, you've got milling, you've got all that kind of thing. And that's going out of business. I mean, milling is going down, the mills are closing. And so the state government in Massachusetts said, we need to do something about that. They talked to the industry people and said, we need to make it possible for Massachusetts to create new industries, to focus on new things. So we will create a school, a university, whose job it is to create the CEOs and the founders of that new industry, those new industries, whatever they are. And that was MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They said it's going to be in the area of technology, which meant something different back then. But they founded this thing called MIT to be a place that would incubate the new generation of people who could come up with new ideas for new companies and give Massachusetts a new economy. And it didn't work. But the one thing to note is, in order to do that, they did something kind of bold. You know, typically in my own country, the UK, in almost all of the United States, and in Germany and most other countries, universities are the academy, the ivory tower, and then you've got industry, and the two are kept well apart. The structures are designed to make that possible. You can't have money flowing between companies and federal funds and things. Universities depend on federal funds, and you can't mix federal and private funds. The US has very strict laws against that. So you've got a problem. Whereas MIT was set up explicitly with money from industry so that you could have federal money coming from the state, like state money coming from the state, as well as federal money. So it would be a non-profit organization. It could get federal funding, wouldn't have to pay taxes, but it would also have funding from industry to do relevant research. And so they created this entity to do that. But it didn't work, so nobody bothered it. I mean, if it had worked, it would have probably been stopped by the government, but it didn't work. I mean, Harvard would probably have complained. For sure they would, because that would have been unfair competition. If Harvard can look at MIT and say, you guys are a university, but you're getting money from private industry and we can't, they'd complain. So Harvard would have shut them down. But they didn't bother because MIT was too small and it wasn't going anywhere. So MIT goes along this way. Then we're into the Second World War, and the US is way behind and needs to sort of build all sorts of new technologies like radar and airplanes and so forth. So suddenly the US in the Second World War has to put huge resources into coming from nowhere to build a war machine. So the US government needed a place where you could mix lots of government money with private money for the munitions firms, etc. And the place that you could do that existed, it was MIT. So in the Second World War, MIT, which was a tiny little nowhere place at the beginning, got millions, millions and millions of dollars that was channeled through MIT to all these research projects that were going on. And in the process, MIT got big. You know, it grew enormously, and it dominated by technology. Radar was, a lot of the US radar work was done at MIT. So that by the end of the 1945, 1946, MIT was a world technology university. It happened because it happened, and it happened fast because of fighting a war effort. One of the people that went over there was a guy called Fred Terman. He was a computer engineer here, an electrical engineer here at Stanford. I shouldn't say computer engineer, he's an electrical engineer at Stanford. And in the 40s, he went out to MIT to join that effort. He saw how this was working. He's looked at it and said, these guys here are taking government money as a non-profit organization, but they're doing research with all this private money as well. They're founding companies, they're incubating companies that are going to spin off from there. And he said, we could do that at Stanford. Because he was already becoming into the administration at Stanford before he went. So he comes back after the Second World War and says, we can do the same here. Not for the hot war, because that had finished, but for the Cold War. For the Cold War, you needed to do the same thing again. So this is how a very wealthy country can sort of very quickly come from behind, in this case against the Soviet Union, to build a defensive system, indeed an offensive system, as it turned out. So he comes back, and he becomes Dean of Engineering, and then eventually became Provost, and he just does the same thing. He makes sure that the money that's going to go into building the new Cold War infrastructure all comes through Stanford, the same way as it did at Stanford. So what does it take to create Silicon Valley? The threat of global annihilation seems to be what it takes. So, you know, do not wish for another Silicon Valley, because the risks are too big. You know, we wouldn't be able to talk about it if we didn't survive that. So he created the park, he created the university. He said he hired faculty who would work with industry. He hired faculty from industry. This was bringing industry onto the campus in a big way. He secured venture capital, either from Chicago or mostly from the East Coast, which is where it was then. Hewlett-Packard was one of the first successful companies that came out of there. so that by the, and this kept going, 50s, 60s, 70s, Stanford was becoming dominant. And then by the early 70s, there were all sorts of semiconductor companies in the area, companies that were using the, those devices, and a whole bunch of, all of this came in. It was just all sucked in on the the coattails of defense, Cold War defense technologies, and the space race, which was sort of part of it. Sending someone to the moon was all a big part of all of this. And it was all coming into Silicon Valley. And it wasn't just that Stanford had this structure. There was some serendipity. Stanford had this structure that made it possible to do this mixing of federal funds and for-profit funds. But there was a whole bunch of other things. You know, you're creating a new industry, you need a lot of land. First of all, this was modern technology, so the buildings are flat. You don't have big towers. You have flat buildings. You have to have a lot of space between them. So you need to have an incredible amount of land, and you need to build on it quickly. You need at least one major airport. If you could find a place with three, wow. You need at least one major university. If you could find a place with three or more major universities, perhaps like Stanford, Berkeley, and San Jose State, even more so. What was here wasn't just a university that had an interesting founding structure. We had an awful lot of land that was flat, could be built on quickly. You just had to bulldoze the orchards, get rid of all those trees, and put these cheap, rapidly built buildings on the land. It's a mild climate, so you don't need to worry about insulation. You can use timber, you can build them very fast. You can build roads quickly. You don't have to put fancy foundations for most places. You just put concrete and asphalt right down on the dirt. You can quickly build a whole new enterprise. All these new companies, all these new buildings for companies can go up there. You've got three big universities that can provide interesting people. You've got Stanford, which by then was very entrepreneurial as a result of the Cold War work. You've got UC Berkeley, which is a big university that can produce an awful lot of people. And then you've got San Jose State, which can produce an enormous number of people with master's degrees in various subjects. So you've got all of the way of creating the people. You can cheaply and quickly build all of the buildings. The climate is nice. People with families would love to come here. They have gardens with pools, etc. It was cheap back then, so you could certainly move in. It was still cheap when I came here in 87, and I should have bought a house here then, but I didn't know I was going to stay. So that's just the way these things go. All of these things were positive. And you've got San Francisco really close, one of the world's greatest cities. So it's an attractive place. It just brought people in. And it was a very tolerant culture. You know, especially in the 60s and 70s technologies, if you don't accommodate alternative lifestyles, you will not be successful. One of the things that killed Pittsburgh, despite Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh, it never made it into the big leagues in terms of high tech and software, etc., because it was an old steel cultured, and they didn't like gays, they didn't like lesbians, they didn't like people of color. All of the people that you need to hire that went there were just driven away. In fact, many of them ended up in Austin, Texas. But you know, all of these things are factors. And again, there are books that talk about all of these things. And it just turned out that this part of the world had everything, including a lot of sunshine and wonderful beaches. And it was really inexpensive then. You were just buying out farms. That's all you were doing. And then VCs came in. The first ones came in the early 70s. Kleiner Perkins was the first one on Sand Hill Road. But this was the thing that made modern Silicon Valley. It was Apple. At $1.3 billion, breathtaking IPO in December 1980, where you have this view of these kids with long hair and blue jeans coming up with this incredibly powerful stuff that could be sold at great profit. So, and that's when not only the VCs came in, but the law firms and all of the other infrastructure you need to make something work as an entrepreneurial center. And now it's the highest concentration. These figures are a year old. I didn't have time last night to find out what the latest is. It's probably gone up a little bit. Actually, could have gone down a little bit. It's an interesting, we're in an interesting moment in terms of whether there's a net inflow or outflow of high-tech people in the Valley, but it's pretty stable. And that's sort of the end of the story. That's how we got here. Okay, so I'm going to sort of get rid of that one. And I want to finish by saying, just listing the elements I've mentioned, the things, and I mentioned these mostly in passing, These are the things people say, what does it take? Well, I've given you the history. Let me just list the things that were part of that story. The number one thing, and this is in order of importance, this is my list, but almost everyone I know in the Valley agrees with this. If you say, what is it that people do more than anything else that makes Silicon Valley successful? It's networking. It's human networking. You know, the irony is we're building technologies that sort of allow people to communicate and do things across the whole globe. You know, we've got companies where, what is it, you've got Hewlett-Packard, 60% of the employees have never actually met their direct report because there's somebody somewhere else in the world. I think 60%, but those figures are sort of common. And in the second talk, I'm going to give my own example just from the inside. This is the global picture. So we're building these technologies that make that work. What it takes to build them is as old as history. It's people, not around the campfire, but people in Starbucks talking about things, people in Pete's Coffee talking about things. If you want to go to the coffee shops, which are the main hubs these days, it's Cooper Cafe, a Stanford spin-off. Cooper Cafe, the most famous one, is actually on Ramona in downtown Palo Alto. You'll be very close to there this evening. If you get a chance, walk around there. You might hear someone speaking English in Cooper Cafe. Actually, you'll probably hear them speaking English, but they're very unlikely to have an American accent. You'll hear Finnish accent, you'll hear German accent, you'll hear everything. And in the morning, it's a complete hive of activity. I've had three meetings in there this week with people in my own little world. Okay, no, actually last week, this is Monday, that was last week. Okay, that's another interesting getaway. You forget weekends in Silicon Valley. You know, it doesn't, you just don't. The only difference is instead of rushing out and spending 90 minutes on a bike, I'll go out and spend 5 hours on a bike. Other than that, the weekend is not different from anything else. So it's a human network. All different kinds of people in a very small geographic area. You can't help but bump into these people. You've got a high density of big tech companies. That's important for creating startup companies. Because first of all, where do startup companies typically come from? Two or three people in a big company have an idea, they leave the company, and because California doesn't have a non-compete clause, they can immediately go and start a company that's going to be competitive, and they do that. And if they're successful, they become a competitor. If they become very successful, the big company buys them and they're back where they started in a bigger office. Or most likely the company will fail, in which case they go back to that big tech company or another tech company and get a job again. So the classic entrepreneurial model is you're in a big company, you start a company, it doesn't work, you go back to a big company, doesn't work, back and forth, back and forth. It's a complete parachute system. You never crash and burn. You crash, you recover, and you go back. And the big tech companies do that. So that density of high tech is important. You've got big, powerful university, culture of involvement industry, what's known as entrepreneurial science. You've got all of that. That's where the mix comes in of the federal research and the private industry, that little hub. Then you've got these big state universities. Cal Berkeley, if two people at Stanford found a company, maybe the first five people that become VPs of divisions come from Berkeley, because it's a much bigger engine. Berkeley produces a lot of people. When they have to hire armies of people that can code and build stuff, they can go down the road to San Jose State University, which generates hundreds and hundreds of master students. These aren't the only ones, but these are the classic key ones in the development of Silicon Valley. And they're all local. You don't have to bring people across country. They're just, you know, when people change jobs in Silicon Valley, you leave your house in the morning and instead of turning left, you turn right and drive a different distance. So you don't have to move house. You don't have to take your kids out of school. You just have to spend an hour or more on 101 waiting for traffic to move out. There's this one, which is huge. And again, these are in order of my order of importance, but it's roughly what everybody else says. The acceptance of failure. This is huge, the fact that no one worries about failure. Failure's literally, and this isn't just one of these things people say, it's really true. It doesn't mean to say people like it. People get distressed about failing, but it's just accepted to be part of the community. It's what it does. So it's literally a culture of risk-taking. And not surprising, if you look at the sociological history, it goes back to the gold rush. I mean, that culture goes all the way back to the gold rush. And we've got Levi jeans, right? You know, the Levi guys were making whale oil on the East Coast, and then the whaling industry died away, and so there was no market for whaling. So those guys came across and said, what can we do? We've got some kind of expertise. We'll actually make clothing for those miners that are going out to the West Coast. And so they came out and they created Levi jeans, and it became a big empire. But it was created in the culture of the whaling industry on the East Coast. And the whaling industry on the East Coast was a very risky business. You know, you're going out into the Atlantic. So whale people that were doing the whale hunting, that was a risky culture, and it was very community oriented. These people were used to competing against each other and working with each other. When they came across that group of people looking for new opportunities, they brought that culture with them, and that grew into the culture of Silicon Valley. So it's accepting failure, accepting risk, being willing to collaborate with your competitor until you can get by without doing that, and then you compete. And then when it fails, you collaborate again. The result is of the successes is that it's seen as a generator of successes, and it is. But that's mainly just a phenomenon arising out of the sheer number of tries. You know, if you throw darts at a dartboard, eventually one will hit the bullseye in the middle, just because there were so many throws. And anyone who lives here knows that. If you know anyone that works in Silicon Valley, in their bedroom or at the back of their wardrobe, they will have a box or a drawer full of T-shirts of the companies that they worked for that no longer exist. My daughter has one of these, and there must be about 20 T-shirts in. And eventually, she ended up at Google, so she ended up with a T-shirt for a company that did quite well. But she had all of these other ones that you probably... Price Radar, she was with for a time. That went out of business, and then she moved on to eBay, and then that didn't go out of business, but she didn't like it there. But everyone has these T-shirts. I don't, because I wasn't part of that world. Actually, I had some of the T-shirts because my daughter gave me some T-shirts, but I didn't earn them. But so anyone who knows, it's all about failure. That's really, and people just brush it off and move ahead. And they learn from it. I mean, the other thing is learn from the failure. Don't make the same mistake twice. Make a different mistake. Okay. This is huge, and I'll talk about this one later on, because this is how I was able to found a company in a very competitive business, the video game industry, that requires an awful lot of skill that I certainly didn't have and couldn't have afforded. So easy access to free advice and assistance from the get-go. That's available in any coffee shop, on any bicycle ride. Don't go to the golf course. There's no one you're interested in goes to the golf course, even if you want to raise money. Buy a bike, a mountain bike or a road bike. If you're in the gaming industry, buy a mountain bike, because all of the people with the money in the game industry have mountain bikes. If you want to get to know Steve Cook, buy a road bike and find out where he's going to be on his road bike. I mean, it's done on bikes. Free access to assistance at the start. There's still massive amounts of government money coming through. It's still that, the four-fifths at Stanford, even higher in the industry, of course. There's still massive amounts lower in the industry. In the industry, it doesn't get that directly. It has to get it through other places. So there's still lots of basic research being done. There certainly is large amounts of private funding to exploit it. Although that's kind of changed, I can talk about that in the second half as well, because this is what I'm going through with my own company. So I'm going to go from big to small and use my own company as an example. Highly fluid workforce. People move all the time. It's very rare for someone in Silicon Valley, if you ask them, if you're on an airplane and you say, where do you work? They might well say Silicon Valley, or they might say San Francisco. They probably won't give you the name of a company. In part because they've probably been to several companies, and as far as they're concerned, they're all as equally bad as all the others, or good as all the others. But people tend not to have an allegiance with companies. You know, if you're with a big company like Google, you can sort of get sucked in for sure. But mostly people are not attached to the companies. They just think those are transient things, and indeed they usually are. Because it's easy to move to another company. You can just chat with someone in a coffee shop. The next thing you know, you've got an interview and you've got a job. In principle, anyone can play, and in the ideal that's true, but you've only got to look at companies like Uber recently to realize that we still have an incredible gender problem in Silicon Valley. It ain't as equal as people like to think it is. In principle, anyone can play, and certainly if anyone is really good, they can absolutely play, but there's still an awful lot of stuff that it's not as good as people sometimes say, and that's why you get these big cases. On the other hand, people do respond to those big cases, and everyone's aware of it. And California now has a rule that no company can have a board without at least one woman on it, which, of course, Trump is trying to kill. But we'll see where that one goes. Because this is still in principle true, in principle. And in many cases, really is true, but not in all cases by any means. But it also means that you really do, you cannot rest on your laurels. People want to know what you're doing now. And that was the one I mentioned, the accepting culture. I mean, San Francisco historically was the place of a very accepting culture. It's very multicultural. I think it's one of the best cities in the world. I mean, Berlin's another one. I mean, that's a great city. Although my familiarity with Berlin was before the wall went down. I've only been back twice since the wall went back. And before, when it was still East Berlin and West Berlin, I was there a lot when I was living in Germany. But that's another story. But yeah, this is still big. Because of the, you just want people hired because of what they can do and what they know, not where they came from, what their history is. And all of those are factors. I mean, you could put more things in, but I think these are essential ones. And if you go to any other part of the world, you'll find one of these at least you don't have. I mean, certainly the large amounts of funding. But the take home message is, you can think of it as because there are really smart people here. Not really. It's because the US had to fight the Soviets in a moment of incredible threat for mankind. And this was the place where it was the easiest and the quickest to do it. And that's all there is to it. We're just here. I mean, we're famous because we're famous, you know. I mean, that's really what we're almost like Kim Kardashian. We're the world's technological hub because we are the world's technological hub. That's why people came here. That's why I came here. That's why we stay here. Yes, Stanford was important. Yes, everything else was important. Yes, I mean, but it was the Cold War. Just like MIT is MIT because of the Second World War. It's just accidents of history. Both accidents that we never ever want to repeat, right? So, let's not wish for another Silicon Valley. And you don't need to. It's great to come here. Use the one that's here. I mean, this is the world's playground, right? You can just, the technology playground, people can just come here. So that was a long thing, but I wanted to give you the whole history in whatever it was, 50 minutes or something. So now we need to take a break. And there's a short talk later on.
You can find more interesting speakers at future Inside Silicon Valley symposiums. More info at leadershipgarage.stanford.edu.